Okay, the beginning of this book is going to talk about a little bit about struggles and hardships, and I'll just tell you that this message tonight was a whole bunch of trouble and hardships. Besides trying to put it all together, last night I was working on the computer and I noticed I wasn't feeling very well, and it just kind of went downhill from there. So I have somewhat of a cold, but I took a whole bunch of medicine, so I hope that will get me through this. And then tying that, I got up to go to work today, and those of you that know this already, I work for the police department. I ride a motorcycle. Well, guess what? When I left to go to work, it wasn't raining. When I then tried to leave work, I have this nice soft cushion on my seat, nice wet cushion on my seat, that I then rode home in the rain, and that didn't help the cold. And then when I got home and finished up my last final little changes, because I'm always changing all this stuff up till the last minute, I went to go print it on my printer, and the printer ran out of ink. So someone evidently doesn't want you to hear. Somebody doesn't want somebody here to hear some of this. So we'll see how that goes. So if I have to take some drinks of water and cough on occasion, that's why it is. We're talking about getting a grip on the power of radical prayer. We're at the end of James. If you don't know that, we have two more weeks, this week and next week, and I will be preaching in both of them. This week we're going to be talking about this last part on prayer, and next week we're going to talk about all of those people that wander away from the faith and what happens to them. And that may get a little controversial, because many of you have heard many different things, and generally there's kind of two different areas people come from, two different viewpoints, and I'm going to try as best I can to ruin both of them and give you something completely different to look at. But today we're going to talk a little bit about prayer. And to understand the end of this letter that we've been studying the last couple of months, we're going to go back, and we're going to go way back. We're going to go back about 900 years before Jesus showed up. God's chosen people, if you don't know this, were split into two at about that time period. And there were a number of reasons for this, but if we had to boil it all down to one, it would be because people just don't get along with other people sometimes. So at that time, the people of God had already started picking sides, basically, and we could really kind of call it the first denominational split. And that denominational split resulted in the Church of the North, also known as Israel, and the Church of the South, also known as Judah. I have a little map up here for those of you that are into maps and stuff. The Kingdom of Israel was to the north, the Kingdom of Judah was to the south. Another important point in there is right at about the middle of that, but in the south is the city of Jerusalem. Now, there was this problem, you see, because the God of both of these denominations basically believed that God himself resided in the south, because Solomon had built many years before a temple for him, and that temple resided in Jerusalem. That temple was built on a mount, and that mount in Jewish tradition was believed to be the location that God gathered up the dust of the earth to make Adam. It's where man came from. That is their belief. And in Jewish tradition and in the Torah, it's talked about as being God's footstool. That's what Jerusalem and the temple was. So with the temple in Jerusalem, the Church of the South basically had control of the government and control of the religious practices within that border. And into this was born a king, and that king was Omri. He became king of the Church of the North. He's one of the kings of Israel at this moment. And as a purely practical matter, he realizes this isn't going to work if all of religion and government is controlled in the south, and I need to make sure that our people are controlled in the north. So I've got to figure out a way to do that, otherwise everybody might go over to the dark side or make a run for the border or join the other team or whatever else, or maybe their membership list isn't going to be as long as the other one. So he had to change something. And that task of centralizing government and religion was pretty straightforward to him. He had a couple ideas that he would do. And the first thing he did is built a new capital, and he did that in Samaria. And he put it up on this hill about 300 feet above the countryside. And And the other thing that he did is he had to deal with this religion issue, and that was a little bit more difficult, a little bit more of a challenge. You see, because the religion in that time required temples, because that's where they had the altar and that's where they did sacrifices. So in order to break away from the Church of the South, in order for the Church of the North to become its own church, he pursued three things. And the first, like all good new denominations, is to plant churches, because that's what everybody does. You just plant churches and that'll work. So what he went around and did is he basically built temples, because those were the churches that they used back then. And he built temples all over. The second thing he had to do was find pastors for those churches. And the pastors in God's church were the Levites. They were the people that God appointed as the pastors. Well, he didn't have the Levites. So instead, what he did is just appointed his own pastors and decided they would rule in their churches. And then finally, the last problem occurred, and that was the people said, wait a second, the temple is in Jerusalem, and that's the only place we're allowed to go worship. And that was a little bit tougher, but what Omri decided to do was, in the temples that he had, he would just dedicate those temples, but he would dedicate them to a different god, and he dedicated them to the Canaanite god, Baal. And basically he said to the people, now you have your own God to worship and you no longer need to go to the south. But there was one man that stood in the way, one follower of the true God that was willing to actually stand up and face Omri and face his son Ahab. And that one man became a symbol to the nation of Israel of the power of radical prayer. And that one man is the man that James mentions in the end of the verses we're going to talk about. So let's try and get a grip of this power of this radical prayer. And I really believe that James has been saying throughout these last 4.5 or so chapters that we've been going through is the idea that we need to turn to God in both the good and the bad times. And that kind of goes right into the first verse we're going to look at, which is, are any of you suffering hardships? You should pray. Are any of you happy? You should sing praises. Basic idea, if you're suffering, if you need help, ask God. If you're happy, if you received help, thank God. You know, we tend to think of prayer as our way out of troubles. It's kind of this idea that we're going to pray to God and he will just rescue us and remove us from our problems, and everything will just fall back into place the way it should be. But we need to go back a minute to the beginning of James and look at the way James looks at the purpose of prayer. He says, and this is from the first chapter of James, it says, dear brothers and sisters, when troubles come your way, consider it an opportunity for great joy. For you know that when your faith is tested, your endurance has a chance to grow. So let it grow, for when your endurance is fully developed, you will be perfect and complete, needing nothing. If you need wisdom, ask our generous God, and he will give it to you. You see, James was never, from the beginning of this book, he was never advocating deliverance from your troubles, and not the kind of deliverance I think that we tend to want. James already made it clear that these hardships that we're supposed to go through, these troubles and these struggles, are there for our own good. They test our faith, as he said, and that builds up our endurance, and that leads to our complete trust in God. So our prayer shouldn't be for complete deliverance. Instead, it should be for wisdom. It should be for patience. It should be for strength. It should be for the strength to endure. It should be asking for God's help through our hardships and our struggles. That's the kind of deliverance that God promises. That's the kind of deliverance James is talking about. And this isn't new. Pastor Glenn and Pastor Tim, both preaching out of Ecclesiastes, have talked about that idea that there is nothing new under the sun. David said this himself in Psalms. He says, when they call on me, and this is God talking, when they call on me, I will answer. I will be with them in trouble. Not I'll take them out of the trouble. I will be with them in trouble, and I will rescue and honor them. It is that idea that God wants to be with us through this. It's like the story of a group of hikers. One day, Joe, Bob, and Dave were hiking in a wilderness area, and when they came upon a large, raging, violent river, they needed to get to the other side, and they had no idea how to do so. So Joe prayed to God, saying, "Please, God, give me the strength to cross this river." And poof, God made his arms real strong and his legs real strong, and he was able to swim across that fighting river. It took him about 2 hours, and he almost drowned, but he got across. Seeing this, Dave prayed to God, saying, "Please, God, give me the strength and the tools to cross this river." And poof, God gave him a rowboat, and he was able to cross the river in about an hour after almost capsizing the boat a couple of times. Bob had seen how all this worked out for the other two guys, so he also prayed to God, saying, "Please, God, give me strength and the tools and the intelligence to cross this river." And poof, God turned him into a woman. She looked at the map, hiked upstream a couple hundred yards, then crossed over the bridge. God's answer was not just to fly them across the river the way we would all like it answered, the way we always look at prayer to be. You know, I wonder sometimes, how do most of us face real suffering? Hardships or rivers? You know, I think we tend to worry. I think some of us tend to maybe plot revenge against the people that caused us some of these struggles or worries. Maybe we let our anger fester inside, and maybe we grumble. We do the why me prayers. And I also wonder, why is it sometimes that we just don't call on God instead? Why don't we just pray for his help? And I think there's three real answers. I think one is just ignorance. I think sometimes we just don't know we should pray. And I hope reading James, you know that's not the case. James just says pray. Paul says pray without ceasing. Another one is arrogance, I think. And I think that's the idea that we think we can handle it. We don't need help. We don't need help from others, and we certainly don't need help from God. We can just do it ourselves. And I think the third one, the sad one, is sometimes shame. I think maybe sometimes that we believe we are responsible for where we are, and sometimes we are responsible for where we are, and so because of that, we believe we can't ask for help. Yet James tells us to pray, no qualifiers, not only under certain circumstances, not only if it wasn't your fault. He just says, pray. If you're suffering hardship, pray. And when God helps, sing. You know, as Christians today, we've really lost a great characteristic of the early church. The early church was known for singing, for praising God. And we've labeled that in many of the scriptures we read it, those verses are translated hymns or psalms or songs of praise. But that's really not what that Greek word actually meant. What it actually meant was to just make noise, to just make noise. You see, the early church was known for making noise about their God. And we don't do that anymore. We don't do it to that extent anymore. Everything is so solemn, it's so quiet, it's so serious. When we talk about prayer, it's all the bad things in life. Yet prayer and praise, according to James, go hand in hand. So when you need help, trust God. And when he helps you, make a lot of noise about it. Now James goes on from hardships to sickness. He says, "Are any of you sick? You should call for the elders of the church to come and pray over you, anointing you with oil in the name of the Lord." The word sick here literally means without strength. And it's used throughout the New Testament to mean both physical strength, a true sickness, and spiritual strength. strength. And they're interchangeable completely. You see, in Judaism at that time, your body, your soul, your mind, your spirit, they weren't separated the way we do that today. They looked at them all as one. If you were sick in any one of them, you were sick in all of them. It's also why the Jews believed that all of your illnesses, your disease, your sicknesses, all were caused by your sin. And James goes on and says, "And the prayer offered in faith will restore the one who is sick, and the Lord will raise him up, and if he has committed sins, they will be forgiven him." The original Greek in these two verses we just read, one saying, are any of you sick? And the other saying, that will restore the one who is sick. There are two different words used. The first one meant, like we said, without strength, and it could mean sickness in a spiritual way or a physical way. This other sickness, this one in which you can be restored from, is specifically a physical sickness. It could be translated lame. So James instructs us with these two verses to call the elders to deal with both physical and spiritual sickness. Now, what's really unique about this is this idea of elders making house calls. This is major, and I don't know if you realize that. James is going way out on a limb here. You need to really understand the role of elders in the church back then to really understand how radical this idea would be to Jewish Christians, the ones James is talking about, the ones who James is. So let's take a second, and we're going to look at elders. In the Jewish tradition, every village appointed elders, and there for small villages, there were 7 elders. For large cities or towns, there were 23. And then there was one large group of elders in Jerusalem, and there were 72 of those. And those are often referred to as the Sanhedrin. And that just, all that means is gathering. The word actually literally translated is session. And in the New Testament sometimes, depending on the version you have, sometimes they will translate the Sanhedrin is only referring to those in that large group in Jerusalem, and then the others they'll just refer to as the town elders. But in reality, back then, they would have all been called Sanhedrin. That's who they were. They were all referred to that, and a proper way of saying it would be the ones in Jerusalem were referred to as the great Sanhedrin to the Jews. The great 70, and they eventually added 2 more, the high priest and another one, but that's for people who are really anal like me. These elders made up these groups were basically the seat of government then. And you got to remember, there was no separation of church and state the way that we look at it today. They were the same. And for them, they had what we would review as a 3-part government, very similar to ours. As a matter of fact, ours comes from this. And what they had was a legislative branch, a lawgiver, and then they had an executive branch or an enforcer, and then they had a judicial branch or the judges. So now in Jerusalem, and this new Christianity James is pointing out in chapter 4, he mentions that one lawgiver. Remember, we covered that a couple of weeks ago. So the lawgiver was already God. That was already pre-decided. We already had his law. So the Jews really didn't, and the Sanhedrin didn't have to come up with laws, although some of them tried to do. Really, they had 2 jobs to do, those 2 other jobs. And those jobs were that executive branch and that judicial branch. And this is kind of the way that it looked out. That old law, and that was God as the lawgiver, you went to the elders, and they provided judgment, and then they punished. And I want you to see the picture of this. Anytime the Sanhedrin was mentioned, anytime you were told you had to go visit the Sanhedrin, it was like being sent to the principal's office. It wasn't going to be good. You were going there to be judged for something that you did and then punished for it. And remember, to them, their belief was that all illness was a result of sin. So here James is telling them to call the elders, these Sanhedrin, and to call them and tell them to actually come to you. But they weren't coming to you to judge you and to enforce the law. They were actually coming to pray, to provide grace, to forgive. This new law has a God that is a spirit giver. It's elders that come to you, and they provide grace and they provide forgiveness. How many of you grew up in a church whose leadership still judged and enforced and still followed the old law? James is pointing out this new way, this new law, this new love, this grace and forgiveness. And just like many of us, the Jews had this picture of God that was one who was an enforcer. He was the judge. He stood over you and he waited until you took a misstep. And now they're being told that that's not the God that we follow. The God we follow, the picture of that God is a father who loves his children, who cares for his children, and who wants to walk with them through their hardships. And these elders were told to anoint you with oil. Often people talk about that oil being a medicinal purpose. And back then, oil, olive oil, was actually used for medicinal purposes. It was used internally and externally as a rub for medicinal purposes. But I don't think that's what James is trying to suggest here, because James doesn't put any qualifiers. He doesn't say if someone comes with a skin sickness or this particular disease or this illness, anoint them with oil, leave the other ones alone. He says anoint them all with oil. Because oil has a different, another meaning in Scripture. People that were anointed with oil, it was to place them under the protection and the direction of God. It was to separate them, to consecrate them, to separate them for God's use. And I think that's what's being called for when James is saying anoint them with oil. It's to put them under the protection of God. It's why James says that the prayer should be offered in the name of the Lord. And it's not necessarily a prayer of healing, the kind that we think of when we think of physical healing. Although it could be, and it does happen, and it did happen then, it's not always the case. Because what that word actually means is to make them whole. They use the word restore that we read, but what it means is to make them whole. It's a prayer that God will provide restoration, that he will put things back in its proper place that they were designed to be. To pray in faith is to pray with the knowledge and desire that God will do what is right. And what is right is whatever God desires to do. James also makes it clear, as Jesus did, that all illness is not the result of sin. But if it is, because sometimes it is, forgiveness is available to those who confess. Which leads us right into James addressing the spiritual sick or the sinner. He says it this way. He says, confess your sins to each other and pray for each other so that you may be healed. The word confessed here, it literally means to blurt it out, basically to get it out in the open, to speak it out. I have a little bit of expertise with confessions. I've obtained some. It's an interesting thing about confessions, about sitting across from somebody and talking to them about a crime they've committed. For some unknown reason, and I haven't figured this out yet, they actually believe that I think they might be innocent. And it's really confusing because I haven't yet brought in an innocent person off the street and accused them of a crime. And I don't mean that jokingly, obviously, to some extent. I guess it could happen theoretically. But it's not like I walk down the street and I say, hey, somebody robbed the bank. Let me pick somebody. I mean, usually there's like evidence that brought us here in the first place. I'm at your door for a reason. I took the money out of your pocket. I have all these things. So reality, when I'm sitting there asking you to confess, It's not because I don't know what happened. What I'm really trying to get you to do is just blurt it out. Get it out. Admit it. When we think about confessing to God, are we confessing to God because he doesn't know what happened? We're confessing to God because God's saying, are you willing to admit it? There is a saying in the recovery movement, you are only as sick as your secrets. It's that idea. Now notice what James does not say. He does not say to go confess to your priest. He does not say to go confess to your pastor or to the police. Okay, maybe you should confess to the police. Never mind that part. He tells us to confess to each other so that you, and that is plural, can be healed. It's not just the person confessing. It's the person they're confessing to needs to be healed. And why would that be? I think what James is really talking about is the healing that occurs when we admit how we have hurt or wronged someone else to their face, to them. When we confess to the very people we hurt. It's really about apology and seeking forgiveness and then praying for each other, for each other's healing. You've heard the saying, it takes two to tango, or that great theologian, Dr. Phil, he says that a single log can't burn. It is the rare instance when only one person is truly responsible for sin. In Rob Bell's new book, and those of you that don't like the word sex, don't read it. Rob tells us that the hurt that we cause each other, and he talks a little bit about that, and the lack of forgiveness we tend not to seek. And he writes it this way. He says, I often meet people who aren't part of a church and don't want anything to do with God because of all those religious hypocrites. Often they have great pain and they blame that on the church. But it's not possible for an institution, whether it's a church or a school or a business or even the government, to hurt somebody. Institutions are made up of people. People hurt people. Somebody in this group hurt somebody in that group. Somebody at that school or that office wronged somebody else, and they haven't done the work to apologize and to make amends and work it through. When I meet someone who has been burned by an institution, my first question is, what was the person's name? It's people hurting people. So when we confess and pray for each other, it's to heal those hurts we've done to each other. And what can we expect out of that? James goes on to say, the earnest prayer of a righteous person has great power and produces wonderful results. And I think we have to be careful here, or we fall into that trap of thinking that it is our power that heals. What James really is saying here is that there is power in the active prayers of a man who is right with God. Earnest prayer really means the active prayers of a man. And there is power in the active prayers of a man who is right with God. Don't confuse righteousness with sinlessness. The idea is that if you have God's heart and God's will and God's desires in your mind and your heart and your soul, then God will work through your ongoing prayers. And it's not because you've somehow moved God toward your desires and your will, but rather you have moved your desires and your will into alignment with God's. Another way to say it is that when we try and follow Christ, when we try to live a Christ-like life, our prayers are more effective because our prayers are God's desires. That's why they're so powerful. I started this message talking about this guy. This guy who 9 centuries before stood up for God. This guy who was one of the greatest prayer warriors in Jewish tradition. This guy was Elijah. Elijah literally means God is Yahweh, meaning God is the God of Israel or the God of the Bible. Elijah's life was all about reminding people that his God was the one true God. His prayers were answered because his God was the one true God. More importantly, his prayers were answered because he aligned himself with the one true God. James tells it this way. He says, Elijah was as human as we are, and yet when he prayed earnestly that no rain would fall, none fell for 3.5 years. Y'all got that? Long time. Then when he prayed again, the sky sent down rain and the earth began to yield its crops. Elijah was as human as you and me. James is a Jew, and his audience is Jewish. This wasn't just some small comment he added here, that people reading it would have just said, oh yeah, we know that, we realize he's just a human. Let me try to give you an idea of how a Jew would have felt about what James just said there. There are these billboards around the country right now that have been put up by a group called the Foundation for a Better Life. And their mission is to encourage values through personal accountability. So they have these billboards that they put up, and we're going to look at a few of them. And you'll see their message, and then you'll see the people that they've picked, the pictures of people they've picked who represent some of these messages. So I just want you to look at one or two. So here's one. As a student, he was no Einstein. If you know anything about Einstein, you know he wasn't a very good student. And they talk about confidence, the fact that he just kept going and just kept pursuing. And Mother Teresa, reaching beyond herself, compassion, Mother Teresa. And certainly Gandhi. What made Gandhi, Gandhi? Soul. Now, if you're like me, and you look at people like Einstein or Mother Teresa or Gandhi, you got to say, I can't compete with that. There's no way. I'm no Gandhi, I'm no Mother Teresa, and I certainly am no Einstein. You see, a Jew would have had that same reaction to what James was saying. A Jew would have said, wait a second, I'm no Elijah. See, Elijah was their Einstein, their Mother Teresa, their Gandhi of prayer. And that was just the point James was trying to make. Elijah stopped rain for 3.5 years. He brought down fire from heaven at will. He even raised the dead. Or did he? Elijah was only human, just like you and me. I think so often that we think of prayer as our way of convincing God, convincing him of what we want, or even asking him for what we need. We have this idea that we can get God on board with us if we just pray hard enough, if we just have enough faith. God will come around to seeing things our way. I mean, really, when we are sowing a seed, it's as if we're telling God, God, make it grow into whatever I ask for. There is this belief out there that God gives us power to do or to make or to cause, or the latest idea, I love this, to attract what we want. The Bible tells us apart from God, we can do nothing. Well, at least nothing that's truly good. James understood that. He understood that it is not the power of Elijah that stopped the rain. It was the power of the God Elijah believed in. The one true God. You see, there are people all over the world who are performing miracles every day through the power of the one true God. The problem is that we are looking for that stopping of the rain instead of looking for the footprints of the rainmaker as he walks through the hardships of all of our lives. We fail to recognize him, and as a result, we fail to make a whole lot of noise. There were a couple of other billboards that I want to show you about people more like us. Team Hoyt. Dick Hoyt, the one pushing there, is Father Dick Hoyt. And his son there is Rick. When Rick was born, his umbilical cord was wrapped around his neck, and it had caused injury to his brain and to his spinal system. And he has very little to no movement, except mainly in his facial area. He was told by his, the father was told, Dick was told by his doctors that he would never amount to anything and you should probably just institutionalize him. And dad and mom both said no, they weren't going to do that. They fought at one point for 2 years to get him into public school. They worked him through public school, and eventually dad got together with some engineers he knew and they developed a system where Rick could just touch a little probe and through that and a computer he could then speak. Rick has since graduated from Boston University. Another thing that they started doing way, way, way back was to run marathons. 65 marathons so far, 206 triathlons. That's a guy who went through some hardship and struggle and took God with him. And if that one still seems to be beyond you, if that's something that you're saying, there's no way I could do that, that's beyond my capabilities, well, here, try something simple. This is a guy named Mike Masiello. Jay, who is was one of the people who were involved in the production of these video or of these billboards and this whole campaign, lives in New York City. He had an old car that he needed some repairs done to, and he was asking people around the city, and particularly the Long Island area, where could I find an honest mechanic in New York City? Well, they referred him to Mike. Mike spent an afternoon, 3 hours, working on Jay's car, and ultimately he couldn't fix it. And when Jay came in to pick up the car, Mike told him, hey, your car is so old, what would need to be done to this, they don't even make the parts for anymore. I cannot fix it, nothing I can do with it. So, of course, Jay said, well, how much do I owe you for at least diagnosing it? And he said, I couldn't fix it, I won't take your money. As simple as that. God showing up in somebody's struggle and hardship. You see, it's not about doing great things. It's about letting a great God, the one true God, enter in the hardships of our life and the lives of people around us to strengthen and to heal and to forgive. You know, I've always wondered, what about the people who during Elijah's time were praying for rain? The ones for that 3.5 years that were just praying their hearts out saying, I'm starving here, I need some rain. Why wasn't God answering their prayers? I mean, how do you answer someone who feels like God doesn't listen to their prayers? Back to Elijah. There is this old Jewish parable on the nature of God's justice. And it tells a story about Elijah and his friend, the rabbi Joshua ben Levi. The rabbi was asked what favor he might wish. And the rabbi was answered only that he be able to join Elijah as Elijah wandered around the community. So Elijah granted his wish, but only if he refrained from asking any questions about any of the prophet's actions. So the rabbi agreed, and they began on their journey. The first place they came to was the house of an elderly couple who were so poor that they had only one old cow. The old couple gave of their hospitality as best they could. And the next morning, as the travelers left, Elijah prayed that the old cow would die. And it did. The second place that they went to, they came to the home of a wealthy man. He had no patience for his visitors, and he chased them away with the admonition that they should get jobs and not beg from honest working people. As they were leaving, they passed the man's wall and saw that it was starting to crumble. And Elijah prayed that the wall be repaired. And it was. Next, they came to a wealthy synagogue. They were allowed to spend the night, and only the smallest of provisions were provided. When they left, Elijah prayed that every member of the synagogue might become a leader. And finally, they came to a very poor synagogue. And here they were treated with great courtesy and hospitality. And when they left, Elijah prayed that God might give them only a single wise leader. As this rabbi Joshua could no longer hold back, he demanded from Elijah an explanation of all these actions. And Elijah replied this way. He said, "At the house of the old couple, I knew that the angel of death was coming for the old woman. So I prayed that God might take the cow instead. At the house of the wealthy man, there was a great treasure hidden in that crumbling wall. So I prayed that the wall be restored, thus keeping the treasure away from that miser." And the story ended with a moral. A synagogue with many leaders will be ruined by many arguments, but a town with a single wise leader will be guided to success and prosperity. And the teaching is this. Know then that if you see a sinner prosper, it is not always to his advantage. And if a righteous man suffers need and distress, don't always think that God is unjust. You see, we don't always see the big picture. For that matter, we don't even usually see part of the picture. James wants to make one last point. And you can miss it if you're not looking. And this was the last part of that previous verse. I don't have it up there. It said, "And the earth began to yield its crops." And the earth began to yield its crops. We have to remember the purpose of prayer. You see, prayer is not about us. It's all about God. It's about people seeing His glory. It's about people enjoying His handiwork. It's about people receiving His blessings. What James wants us to do is, when we need help, trust the one true God. And we do that by asking for patience and for strength and for endurance to grow through our hardships. We ask for healing of our relationships. We ask for forgiveness. And we align our desires and our will with God's desires and will. And if we ask for anything more or anything less, what we are really doing is creating our own God, like Omri did in the time of Elijah. The one thing that we all need to do a better job in is that when God does help us in His way and in His time, we really need to make a whole lot of noise about it so that the world may hear. I want you guys to talk about that. I want you to talk about thinking of a time when prayer that you prayed was clearly answered. What happened? What was it about? And how did that answer glorify your God? And then go the other way. Think of a time when it wasn't answered the way you wanted it answered. How did that happen? What happened there? And just out of curiosity, how did that answer glorify God? And then the last, we do this each time we meet, but really this comes from this idea. And that is, as a group, go through your highs and your lows. And that's what those always were. Those were your praises and your need for prayer. So I'll leave you at that.